parsha of Kisavo opens with the mitzvah Bikurim. And if we take a look, the psukim, we read them, we hear them, we're familiar with them, but sometimes there's even basic questions that perhaps may pass us by, or maybe we may pass them by. In Pasuk Beis of Perek Kaf Vav, so it reads, V'lokachta merishis kol pri hadama, asher tovi me'artzacha, you shall take from the first the fruit of your land, that you will bring from your land, asher Hashem elokecha nosenach, that Hashem will give you, v'samta v'atene, put them in a basket, and bring them to the Beis HaMikdash. Already, and perhaps sometimes when you just have to read something slowly, you take it word for word, and you already get a sense of what's coming. The opening phrases, Mereshis kol pri ha'adama, the beginning of the fruits of the land, Asher tovi me'artzecha, which you will bring from the land, and that seems to be somewhat wordy, because the fruits of the land is what you bring from the land. Is there not some more compact or linear way that we could have communicated all of that? Is it even to say, or vehevesa, mereshis artzacha, or mereshis briha adama? But it seems to have been divided into two. The first of the land that you will bring from the land. That's too many lands in the pasuk. So how are we to understand the way that it's, the reason it's phrased in this way? And this question is discussed by the Netziv of Voloshin in his Perush HaMikdavar, and as we know, aside from being the Rosh Hashiva of Voloshin, he's a master of Parshan. And the Netziv alerts us to the fact that the word Reishis actually has two connotations. On the one hand, it means the first of something, and sequentially or chronologically, it's the first followed by others. But the word Reishis also has the connotation of the choice of something, the best of something. Like we say, Reishis Chochma Yiras Hashem, the choice of all Chochma is Yiras Hashem. And the truth is, with regards to mitzvos hatluyos ba'aretz, we find the term Reishis used in both settings. And it's interesting to illustrate through example, and we get a sense of what we're talking about. On the one hand, the mitzvah of Truma is called Reishis. Reishis degoncha, tirishcha, v'yitzarecha. It's the Reishis of your produce. Now, we know that Truma does not have to be the first of the produce at all. It is absolutely not a concern. But the Pasuk says that it's Reishis. There, it uses the term Reishis to mean the choice. You should bring Truma from the choice of your crop. Reishis in that way. Number one. In terms of quality, not necessarily in terms of sequence. On the other hand, in last week's parsha, there is the mitzvah of Reishis Hagez, which is one of the 24 Matnos Kehuna. The first of the shearing of the sheep goes to the Kohen, Reishis Hagez. Not the choice, necessarily. I mean, one shouldn't look for the lowest quality, but it is explicitly and specifically the first shearing. And there we find Reishis in the sense of sequential. That being the case, we come back to the mitzvah of Bikurim, and the mitzvah of Bikurim is also Reishis, and the question is, which type of Reishis is it? Is it the Reishis, that is to say, the first of the fruits to ripen, or is it the choice of the fruits to ripen? And the answer is yes. Meaning, in this situation, in this mitzvah, both aspects of Reishis are required for the mitzvah. And that is why there are two, it is introduced in two ways. On the one hand, it says, V'lokachta me'reishis kol pri ha'adama. That compares it with the other fruits, with the other produce, and it's the Reishis of them. In that respect, it is the Reishis in terms of quality. But the next phrase, which says "Asher tavi me'artzecha," which is an action, that is about sequence, as if to say it's the first that you bring, because it's the first that becomes available, as if to say it is the choice of the first that becomes available. And that's Asher Tavi Me'artzecha. So phrase one, Reishis Kopriha Adama, is Reishis in terms of quality. Phrase two, Asher Tavi Me'artzecha, is the other connotation of Reishis, that it's the first chronologically. What's interesting is, with this Perush, the Netziv is invoking a concept which is called Moshech Atzmo V'Acher Imo. Literally, it draws itself and another with it. And what does that mean? It means that sometimes you can have a word that is the beginning of two phrases and it's not repeated, but it's as if it was repeated, as if to say it qualifies both. It's this word before the first phrase, so the two phrases are almost both drawing from this opening word. Moshech Atzmo V'Acher Imo. It's an introduction word which is qualified by two phrases. And what that means for our purposes is that the word Reishis is one of those words. It's Reishis, but two types of Reishis. Reishis number one is Kopriha Adama, and then Reishis number two is Reishis Asher Tavi Me'artzecha. So this understanding takes the word as if it's echoed, as it qualifies both, or introduces both phrases. Moshech Atzmo V'Acher Imo. What's very interesting and perhaps unique about this situation is, as much as it's used twice, when it echoes, it doesn't echo in the same way, because as it's taken as repeated, it's a different type of Reishis. The first, as we said, quality, the second, sequence, and nonetheless, the word Reishis is the header for both of those different types of Reishis. So that's the comment of the Netziv, pure parshanut, we could say, but again, once he's raised the question, the pasuk now seems glaring in that way. It's hard to read it as if that's the shortest way to say it, because it is in fact saying two distinct things. Okay, moving on within Bikurim. As we know, there is a mitzvah to accompany the bringing of Bikurim with a certain declaration. It becomes more famous in our experience from Seder night, where we break it down into pieces, but the whole thing here at once is what's called Mikra Bikurim, the declaration of Bikurim. It's like a mini recap of Jewish history from the beginning until now, starting with the famous Aramia Vedavi, Vayered Mitzrayim, we go through Yetzias Mitzrayim, etc., and here we are bringing Bikurim. Now, it's very easy, and especially on Seder night, it's very easy to miss the following question, but when you see the pasuk put together, it's actually something which needs to be responded to. Pasuk Hey, Ve'onisa Ve'amarta Lifnei Hashem Elokecha. You shall respond and say before Hashem, Arami Aved Avi Vayered Mitzrayim. So Arami, we know from Rashi quotes it, Unklus translates even this way, and then that's from the Chazal. Arami Aved Avi is Lavan. Lavan tried to destroy Yaakov in whatever way that he did, however we understand it. Arami Aved Avi, Vayered Mitzrayim, Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim, Vayagar Sham, and from that point on, we're in Mitzrayim, and then we leave Mitzrayim, etc., and so forth. But what's important to realize is just how seemingly disjointed this opening phrase of Arami Aved Avi. Because if we take the pasuk as a sequence of events, it seems to be almost misleading, which of course it isn't, but this is not the sequence of events. Arami Aved Avi, Lavan tried to destroy Yaakov, and then what happened? The next thing we hear, Vayered Mitzrayim, Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim. You'd almost get the impression that these two are connected, that one is the cause of the other, which it isn't. Because Arami Aved Avi, whatever happened with Lavan and Yaakov, what that happened, and then it stopped happening, and then Yaakov came back to Eretz Canaan. Many other things happened, and there's Yosef and the brothers, and then years later, Vayered Mitzrayim. So it's true that going down to Mitzrayim happened after Lavan tried to destroy Yaakov. It happened after lots of things. It doesn't mean that they were the cause. It doesn't mean that A led to B. But it sounds like Arami Aved Avi in some way led to Vayered Mitzrayim. But question, how so? To borrow Rashi's famous phraseology, Ma inyan Arami Eitzel Yerida Mitzrayim. What's one thing got to do with the other? And this question has bothered Rishonim all the way down to our times, ve'ad bichla, including our times as well. And once again, we come back to the Netziv. And the Netziv says a chiddush. But essentially, he's just bringing us back to what the Haggadah tells us. What's important to remind ourselves with regard to our time in Mitzrayim is that all things being equal, it did not have to necessarily be in Mitzrayim specifically. As if to say, the Brit Ben Abesarim, when Hashem foretells to Avram, Ger Yezarecha, Be'eretz Lelehem, your descendants will be in land which is not theirs. Which land? Doesn't say. Could be any land. Now, if that's the case, so let's ask an interesting shaila. Is there any other country that we may have thought that the Golus should take place in? And the answer is, yes. Aram Naharaim. And the reason why is because we were already there. It's very interesting to think about it, but if we just have the general forecast that Avram's descendants will be strangers on a land which is not theirs, and then move forward two generations, and Yaakov finds himself as a stranger in a land which is not his, and he even uses the expression, Im Lavan Garti, he was a ger with Lavan, it sounds like all conditions are met. We're not tied to any specific place. One could even have envisaged that somehow he'd be either encouraged or forced to stay there, as in the end he was forced to stay in Mitzrayim. And when you choose your country, Yaakov is told he can't leave until it's over. So he's already in a land which answers to all qualifications. So why not stay there? But he did not stay there. He was brought back, and then there was more time in Eretz Canaan, and then into a different land, which ended up being Eretz Mitzrayim. But the question is, if a land which is not theirs, namely Aram, is staring you in the face, and you're already there, and conditions are right to fulfill the Bris Ben Abesarim, how come you leave there and go somewhere else? But the answer is in the words, Arami Ovei Davi. The Haggadah says something which is quite surprising, and needs to be understood for itself. But we do say that what Lavan tried to do was worse than what Paro tried to do. We say that Paro lo gozar el al zachar. He tried only to destroy the males, which is bad enough. But we do compare and contrast him with Lavan. And we say, V'lavan bikesh la'akor sakol. Lavan tried to destroy everyone and everything. And if that's true, then really what we're saying is that the Bris Ben Abesarim could not be where Lavan was because it was too harsh. Meaning, as harsh as Mitzrayim was, Lavan would be worse. Because we say that what Lavan wanted to do was worse than what Paro wanted to do. Therefore, and moreover, the Tziv suggests that the Haggadah statement, which we take at face value, and we don't necessarily try and go behind it, which we say, Lavan was worse than Yaakov. Who told you Lavan was worse than Yaakov? Why did they even need to be compared? And moreover, why does anyone need to be worse than Paro? Paro at least should have his evening as the worst person in the story. Even that is taken away from him. He's the villain, and he wasn't even the biggest villain. We're stealing his negative thunder. But why is it important? Why is it of even relevant to note that there was someone who was worse than him? And how do we know? But the Netziv said it appears that the Haggadah got it straight from our pasuk. That's why the two phrases are related, as if to say we were in Aram, but look what he tried to do. It was too much. And therefore, it did lead to going down to Mitzrayim. Because since what Lavan tried to destroy everyone, we couldn't stay there. Aye, what about Eretz Lelem? It's got to be somewhere else. And in the event, for other reasons, it became Mitzrayim. But we couldn't stay in Aram. And that's the connection between the two phrases. They are connected. It wasn't a direct link, as if to say we didn't go straight from Aram to Mitzrayim. But we had to leave Aram and therefore ended up in Mitzrayim. That's the comment of the Netziv, which again is fascinating and thought-provoking. What he doesn't discuss, and I wonder whether someone else does, is that when we think of it, the Netziv is alerting us to the fact that Aram and could conceivably have been the setting for the Bris Ben Abisarim. And in the end, it wasn't because it was too harsh. But the question is, well, is it entirely deleted from the equation of a Bris Ben Abisarim? You couldn't stay there the whole time. You had to leave after a certain point. But we were there for a certain amount of time. And that amount of time qualified in every respect, or certainly the preliminary respect, we were Ger Yerzarecha Be'eretz Lelahem. So is that on the clock for Bris Ben Abisarim? Or do we say, well, if you couldn't stay there the whole time, so then everything gets reset? And we're sorry about the 22 years, but it doesn't count because 22 years are not really that much. And therefore we start from zero and you've got to start somewhere else. But why? It cannot be shared out, especially as in the event we were not in Mitzrayim for 400 years either. But we don't discount the time that we were there, which seems like it's not all or nothing. But if it's not all or nothing, then perhaps it can be both. It can be both Aram and Mitzrayim. But then the question is how to put them together. When we've got 400 years, we were there for 210 in Mitzrayim. Yaakov was with Lavan for 20 years. Does that give a total of 230? No one speaks in those terms. But why do we forget the years of Lavan? I wonder, and this is only a suggestion to suggest, but I wonder if anyone says that this is really what's behind the missing years of Mitzrayim. As if to say, there were almost 200 years missing from Mitzrayim. Out of the 400, we're there for 210. It's 190 missing. Who knows if perhaps those 190 were really, because we do work with quality, perhaps the difficulties with Lavan meant that every year was like a tenfold year of Golas, so that the 20 years, give or take, in Aram accounted for 200 years worth of Golas. And therefore there's another 200 plus a little bit to make up in the other place. I suggest that only as food for thought. If anyone proves me wrong, I'm prepared to retract immediately and in advance. But I do think that the question is certainly worth pondering in that way. Having seen that it could have happened in Aram, it didn't finish there. The question is, did it start there? That, I believe, is a very interesting shaila. So these are some of the comments from the Netziv with regards to the mitzvah of Bikurim and the declaration that we say when we bring Bikurim. And from there, let's move from declaration to declaration. There's the Mikra Bikurim, Aramiya Vedavi, but there's another, perhaps lesser discussed declaration which takes place in the Parsha, and that is known as Vidui Maaser, which is Sheni in the Parsha. It's Perek Kaf Vav, Pasuk Yud Beis. And here, the background is in Pasuk Yud Beis, where it's the 6 years leading up to the Shemitah cycle. Shemitah is number 7, but the first 6 years are divided into two units of three. And at the end of every 3-year mini-cycle, a person makes a declaration that he has disposed of all of his maaseros in the way that he needs to. He's given his maaser rishon to the Levi, he's dealt with his maaser sheni as he should, which is to take it to Shalayim, and in the appropriate year given maaser oni, that second tithe. It's all, he's done the right thing by maaseros. It's very unusual that a mitzvah is accompanied by a declaration that a person has fulfilled the mitzvah. And Rishonim ponder the question as to what is the meaning of this declaration in terms of Tamei HaMitzvahs. You've got to do the mitzvah, but why do you then have to declare that you did the mitzvah? Well, Sefer HaChinuch says something very interesting. And again, one could yet ask, why is it only true for here? But the Chinuch says, you know, it's part of human nature that if a person has, shall we say, certain obligations, he may forget to fulfill them. He may find a way that it didn't happen and just ignore them, perhaps, or avoid them. It can be, which is not a good situation, but it can happen. Once there is a follow-up mitzvah to declare that the person has fulfilled those mitzvahs, that's already something else. It's one thing to say that a person may neglect to give maaser, but that person will not declare that he gave maaser. if he neglected to do so. There's always a person that will, but in terms of the general assessment. And therefore, because the Torah wishes to ensure that there are people who rely on the master, it's the lahavdil, right, ben kodesh l'chol, it's its own form of welfare, as if to say it is built into the system, that there's the maaser for the Levi, then there's the maaser for the Ani. There are people that rely on this, and therefore the Torah wants to ensure that it happens. How does the Torah ensure that it happens? Well, number one, the Torah has obligated you to do it, okay, hopefully that will go a long way, but for those who still might know that the Torah told them to do it, but somehow it doesn't happen, the Torah says, and say that you did it. Because now that you have to say that you did it, you'll do it. And you won't forget. It occurred to me that perhaps this explanation of the chinuch, which is actually very fascinating, because it's really about human nature, perhaps that may explain why this declaration has the name that it does. This declaration is known in halacha as Vidui Maaser, the confession of Maaser. And Rishonim and Achronim are quite curious as to why this declaration is called Vidui. I mean, we're heading up for Vidui just in a couple of weeks. Our Vidui doesn't sound like that. If your Vidui is only about all the things that you did right, I think Vidui would be much more popular. But as it is, we associate Vidui with a person expressing something that perhaps they did not do completely right, or maybe did wrong. I mean, that's vidui in this respect. So how do you attach the idea of vidui to a declaration? All you did is you talk about your mitzvahs. You know, with viduis like that, we could do quite well. But perhaps there is an aspect of shortcoming that is contained within this declaration, and that's why it's called vidui. Namely, you're not saying that you did anything wrong. You're saying that you did everything right. But it's a vidui because the Torah says, be sure to say it, because otherwise you might not do it. In other words, it's in recognition of the shortcoming that made this required to make this declaration. That's where it's a vidui. It's a recognition of the fact that I need to say this, otherwise I might not do it. That's the confession here, perhaps as a suggestion. A second way of understanding what's behind this declaration, why it's so important, is to be found in the writings of the Akedas Yitzchak, Rabbeinu Yitzchak Aramo. And as we know, he was one of the great, shall we say, philosophical commentaries on the Torah. He himself was expelled from Spain. He's in that time. And he has a great deal in the Sefer Akedas Yitzchak. It follows the Parshas, but it deals with many, many basic topics in Judaism. And the Akedas Yitzchak says that there is special meaning to the Torah requiring you to declare before Hashem, and the Pasuk says that, in Pasuk Yud Gimel, V'omarta lifnei Hashem Elokecha, you shall say before Hashem, that you gave all the masters. Why is that so important to say that? And the Akedas Yitzchak says, there is perhaps a notion that, as we know, the Torah is divided into two categories of mitzvahs. There's bin Adam lach makom, bin Adam lach havero, between man and God, between man and man. And sometimes the Torah is so effective in taking care of people that it's possible to lose sight of the fact that all those mitzvahs that are about taking care of people are also mitzvahs. They're also religious. They're also spiritual. They're also part of what connects a person to Hashem. From a certain point of view, as we've mentioned in the past, the mitzvahs that involve taking care of others bring about a closer connection with Hashem than actually mitzvahs ben Adam lamakom. The reason being that in to a significant degree, the concept of closeness in spiritual terms is that of likeness. When ideas are close, right? That means that they're very like each other. A person attains an affinity with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's how he attains that closeness. But how do you get that affinity? By emulating him, and that's by taking care of others. And that's a very important, there's almost like there's a Ruach HaChaya within all these between man and man mitzvahs that actually allows for a connection between man and God that even man and God mitzvahs do not have. And that's why it's a full program. But it's easy to lose sight of that. It's easy to see it simply as looking out for someone else, which is a very good thing, but forget that it's a mitzvah. How are we reminded? And it's not healthy. It's not right to do that, because the Torah is one. The 613 mitzvahs of the Torah are one. The Torah is not complete without all of those mitzvahs. To detach some of those mitzvahs and to turn them purely into social endeavors and not spiritual endeavors is to undersell them and not to do justice to them. And to that end, says Akedah Tzitzchak, the Torah says, in this instance, you have this mitzvah, it's pure welfare, seemingly. It's pure taking care of your fellow. But report back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and tell him that you did it. In other words, speak about it with him, because that's what reminds you that it's part of his will, it's part of his program for you, and it is a mitzvah no less than the other mitzvahs, with all the spiritual qualities involved. That's what happens when you take a ben adam l'chaveiro mitzvah, but you require it to be followed up with what you could call a ben adam l'makom dialogue or report. And I believe that this idea perhaps, and it's a sensitive idea, because it's not yes or no, but it's a nuanced idea. No one is saying that the part of what the Torah wants is for you to take care of your fellow. But it's part of what the Torah wants, and that's the full picture. And perhaps this can shed light on a famous discussion which relates back to last week's parsha with regards to the mitzvah of Kan Sipur. Kan Sipur, the mitzvah to send away the mother bird when you take the young, and that's the mitzvah. Now, there's a very interesting Mishnah, which actually appears twice in Shas, in Brachos, and in Maseches Megillah, which talks about a list of things that if a person says these things, we tell them to be quiet. We silence them. It's a very interesting Mishnah. I mean, the Mishnah deals with all aspects of halacha. And now you know there's halachas of silencing a person. And how many things are on that list in the Mishnah? Three or four. I think the list has expanded with time for reasons that are as much artistic as they are halachic. But back in the day, there's only three things that a person can say that you tell them to be quiet for. And among them, for example, if a person says modim modim, well, really what all these three things have in common, as we will see them one by one, is that the person means well. He means it as a good thing. He doesn't realize that there's danger to what he's saying, and that sometimes also happens. And that's why we need to silence him. Modim modim. He, as far as he's concerned, he took the greatest word you can say and said it twice. What could be better? He's doubly thankful. But we're very sensitive, and certainly back in the day, and it continues until our day, you do not wish to repeat something in that way. Because when you're praying, and you're praying to the deity, it's got to be abundantly clear that there's only one deity that you're talking to, and therefore one modem is enough. Sometimes twice is not twice as good, because if it has the connotation of two, so then better that you stuck with the one. That's the... That's one thing, and therefore we silence him. He says, modim, modim, what could be better? No, it's not so good. Or if a person says to Hashem, similar to the first one, al hatov yizacher shemecha, may your name be remembered for good things, only for good things. Wonderful, what could be better? But it's a very dangerous thing to say, because the implication is, and if something bad happens, someone else's name should be mentioned? So a person has not thought these things sufficiently through. He thinks he's being very frum. He doesn't realize that he's potentially saying something very damaging. So we tell him to be silent. And what's the third thing on the list, which is actually the first thing mentioned? If he says, Al kan sipur yagiyu rachamecha, which the Gemara explains to mean that as part of a prayer, he says to Hashem, in the same way that you had Rachmanis on the mother bird, and that's really what it's all about, that the mother bird shouldn't see the young being taken. So have Rachmanis on us as well. I mean, that's really what it means. You had Rachmanis on the mother bird, have Rachmanis on us as well. And we tell him to be silent. And the question is, why? What did he do wrong? It's very nice. It's Rachmanis. It's good. What's the danger? So one of the two explanations of the Gemara is, he's made a mistake. He has turned mitzvos into rachamim, into mercy. But they're not. They're gezeros. They're divine decrees. So it's wrong for him to say that. It's wrong for him to say that sending the mother bird away is an exercise in mercy. It's not true. That's not mercy. It's divine decrees. Now, the simple implication of that explanation of the Gemara is that it's wrong to say that what's behind or the reason for the mitzvah of sending away the mother bird is to have mercy on the mother bird. That's wrong. Don't say that. And by the way, it sounds like you shouldn't really give a reason for any mitzvah because mitzvahs are divine decrees and don't get involved in giving reasons. We know that's not so. We know that we're encouraged, I mean, if one is qualified, and certainly we've seen throughout the ages, from Chazal, almost pretty much until our time, the greats of the generations, they engaged in giving reasons for mitzvahs. And the Rambam says in the Mishneh Torah, in the Filchas Me'ilah, that a person should try and fathom the reasons for the mitzvahs to the extent of his ability. Except whatever happened to that Mishnah, we silence a person who tries to say that the reason for the sending away the mother bird is mercy. So the question is, do we encourage it or do we silence it? Because they don't sound like the same thing. But as Mefarshim point out, and perhaps just the nuance for our discussion, perhaps the Ramban is closest as a basis for what we're about to say. One should advance reasons for mitzvahs. One should engage in trying to understand the reason for a mitzvah, but not to forget that it's a mitzvah. As if to say, when a person makes a prayer like that, you had Rachmanis on the mother bird, what he's done is he has made the totality of the mitzvah about having Rachmanis on the mother bird. That's not all there is to it. There's another underlying aspect to it. It's a mitzvah. And in a sense, this person has completely dropped that from his portrait, his depiction of the mitzvah of Yom Kippur. And that's a mistake. And it's the same mistake that the Akedas Yitzchak is saying. If a person could give Meiser and think, it's just about taking care of the Levi, it's got nothing to do with the mitzvah, it's got nothing to do with, there is no godly element with it, I'm just helping someone out. And a person may think similarly, when I send away the mother bird, I'm being nice to a bird. And forget that it's a mitzvah, with all that goes with that. And that's why, to advance reasons within the mitzvah is a very laudable thing. To take the mitzvah and turn it into the totality of the mitzvah is potentially a very wrong thing. And that's what's behind Meshatkin also in that case. So these are the comments of the Rishonim with regards to their own Tameha mitzvahs for the declaration of having given the Meiser. Again, in brief, for the Chinuch, to make sure that you do it, because if you said you did it, you'll have done it. And to the Akedas Yitzchak, to remember, if you talk to God about it, it's because of a godly thing. Remember, it's a mitzvah. Okay. Now, in the end of Pasuk Yud Gimel, there is an interesting phrase which has caught the attention of many Mefarshim. We'll read the Pasuk from the beginning. This, as we say, is a declaration. The person has done everything right. Va'amarta lefnei Hashem Elokecha, you should say before Hashem, bi'arti HaKadosh min habayis, I have appropriately disposed of all of the holy material from within the house. Vegam nesativ la'levi, la'ger, la'yason, va'amona, I've given it to all of those to whom I'm meant to give it. K'chol mitzvasecha asher tzivisani, in accordance with the mitzvah that you commanded me. I did not transgress any of those mitzvahs, and I didn't forget. So interestingly, again, it's not the direction that we're headed, but fits in very well with the Sefer HaChinuch, because that's really what he's saying. If I didn't have to say that I did it, I might have forgotten. And forgetting can take many forms, and some of it involves a great deal of planning, but it can happen. But Rashi comments on the words v'lo shach, because what does it mean? It does stick out a little bit. You said you've done everything, and then didn't forget. What didn't you forget? You've already done everything. So what is there to forget once a person's done everything? That's a good shaila. And therefore Rashi's comment briefly is v'lo shachachti, I didn't forget, milivarechacha, I didn't forget to bless you, al hafroshas masros, overtaking meiser. So in our words, what Rashi and his sources in the Mishnah, as we'll see, what Rashi is saying is, I've done all the mitzvahs and I didn't forget to make a bracha over it. Now, This explanation is very significant because Rashi is bringing in the concept of making a bracha overtaking maaser and explaining that that's what the pasuk is talking about. The understanding that we might glean from this is that at least in this mitzvah, and maybe in other mitzvahs, the idea of making a bracha over the mitzvah is itself a Torah requirement. Anything the Torah requires that you say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in fulfillment of your declaration means, of your obligation, means it is a Torah obligation. Now, if you say, I didn't forget to make a bracha, that means that's also part of your Torah obligation. But the question is that so? Is it so that to make a bracha over even a Torah mitzvah is itself, the bracha, a Torah obligation? We don't need to look too far into the Shas in order to discover that it is not a Torah obligation. The Gemara in Maseches Brachos and Daf Tes Vav explicitly states that even if the mitzvah is a Torah mitzvah, what, then 613 of them, but any bracha that you make over a mitzvah is drabana. And it actually gives the specific example of taking Trumas and Maaseros. That's black on white. It's not from the Torah. Well, if it's not from the Torah, what are we to do with this comment of Rashi, which is based on the Mishnah in Maaser Sheni, which explains the words of the Torah, V'lo Shachachti, as a reference to the bracha? The simplest answer, I believe, is found in the two foremost commentaries of Rashi, super commentaries of Rashi, Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi and the Maharal in Nugur Aryeh. And they both say largely the same thing. And what they say is, we need to be sure not to make a wrong association. When we hear a bracha on taking maaseros, we think of Asher Kedushanu b'mitzvos v'tzivanu lafrish trumos maaseros, or whatever the bracha is. That's the Rabbanon. That's not what the pasuk is talking about here. When the pasuk says, I didn't forget to bless you at the time that I took maaseros, it's not a bracha on the mitzvah of maaser, but it's a word of blessing to Hashem for giving you enough food to take trumas and maaseros from. In other words, there comes a time when a person gives, and as much as you're being very generous in your giving, you count your blessings that you have what to give. That's not the time that you're upset. Look, I have to give. When you're in a position to give, and that's really that's the greatest blessing. Mindful, just parenthetically, but that I was told by a cousin of mine. The pasuk says in Parshas Re'eh, with regards to the mitzvah of tzedakah, it says, "Al kein anochi mitzavcha lemor." I'm telling you, I'm commanding you that you need to open your hand to your brother, to your fellow. It's the mitzvah tzedakah, pasach tiftach. Ani mitzavcha lemor. So my cousin told me that when the Rav Abramsky, that's all, when he was very ill and housebound, so the Gera Rebbe paid him a visit. Okay? So here's the Rebbe, he's come to visit Rav Abramsky. And the Rebbe says, I'd like to tell you a vort, but it's a Hasidic vort. I'm just warning you in advance. And therefore I'm asking your permission, because I know that you're really not the Hasidic at all, you're Litvak. So do you mind if I tell you a Hasidic vort? So, I mean, he had a captive audience. I mean, Rav Abramsky was literally, couldn't escape. But Rav Abramsky said to him, listen, there's two types of vorts, really. There's good vorts and bad vorts. So he said, you know, if it's a good vort, I'm prepared to hear it, even if it's Hasidic. And if it's not a good vort, I wouldn't want to hear it, even if it's not Hasidic. So you need to decide if it's a good vort or not. So the Sfasemis, not the Sfasemis, it was much later, whoever it was, Lev Simchur, he said, it's a good vort. So Rabbi Bramsky says, okay, let's hear. So the Rebbe said, the Pasuk tells you, you've got the poor person, you're giving him tzedakah. Al kein anochi mitzavcha lemor pasach tiftacha. I'm commanding you, the simple translation, I'm commanding you to open your hand, to give tzedakah. But the Torah says more than that. Not only am I commanding you to open your hand, I'm commanding you to say pasach tiftach. And what does that mean? What it means is the greatest thing that you can give to someone in need is to say to him that in the fullness of time, you too will open your hand to someone else. In other words, I'm not just telling you to open your hand. I'm telling you to tell him that he will open his hand. Encourage him, and perhaps it's only temporary. He'll recover. He'll get back to himself and whatever. Reverend Rumsey said, it's a good word. So this is the bracha. It's a person, he has what to give, right? He's giving his meiser, and therefore it's a bracha to Hashem, not on the mitzvah of giving meiser per se. That's the Rabbanon, but on the fact that he has what to give. That's how the Mizrahi and the Gur Aryeh explain. Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank does have a comment here. Because the truth of the matter is that as much as we know, and we've stated, and it's true, the Gemara says that brachas over mitzvos are derabbanon. They are. The Gemara says that. That's the position of the Gemara Talmud Bavli. However, the Yerushalmi appears to differ on this point. The Yerushalmi appears to say that brachas over mitzvos are actually d'oraisa. And where does it learn it from? It learns it from the pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim. Hashem tells Moshe, Alei Elai Hahara, ascend the mountain, and I will give you HaTorah, Luchos, HaTorah, VaHaMitzvah, etc., and so forth. And the Yerushalmi says, look at those words, HaTorah and HaMitzvah. And you see that in putting them together, the Torah has equated them. Equated them in what way? As we know, there is a Torah mitzvah to make a bracha before Torah. According to many opinions, that is the Oraisa, an exception. But the Yerushalmi says, Torah and mitzvah. They're the same. In the same way that one makes a bracha over Torah, one also makes a bracha over mitzvahs. That's the Yerushalmi's exposition of that phrase. Now, the simple understanding of the Yerushalmi, and we might not paskin like that, but the simple understanding of the Yerushalmi is that making a bracha over a mitzvah itself is a Torah obligation, a Torah v'hamitzvah. The reason why the Talmud Bavli differs and says that a bracha is drabanan is because we happen to know that it has a completely different approach to those words, HaTorah v'HaMitzvah. Rish Lakish tells us in Brachas Tavhei that those words, v'HaTorah v'HaMitzvah, are a description of the various parts of Torah that were given to Moshe at Sinai. Torah is Chumash, Mitzvah is Mishnah, Asher Kasavti l'Harosam, Nevi'im Ksuvim, Gemara, whatever those categories mean in that context, to teach you that everything was given to Moshe at Sinai. And therefore, says Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank, if you wish to have a broader perspective here, if you see someone who seems to imply that making a bracha over a mitzvah is from the Torah, don't be thrown by the fact that we know from the Gemara that it's not from the Torah, because that's the position of the Bavli. Perhaps his comment reflects the position of the Yerushalmi, and we know that they're in machlokas, in dispute, over how to understand the words HaTorah v'HaMitzvah. So that's a Tzvi Pesach Frank, just making Seder between the Bavli and Yerushalmi, which if you can do it, is a very good thing to do. Just one final comment with regards to this Vidui Maaser. It's very interesting for all the reasons that we've said. There's a mitzvah to declare, it's a chiddush that it's called Vidui, and a further chiddush in Pasuk Tes Vav. Psukim Yud Gimel and Yud Dalet are all the declarations that a person has fulfilled his obligations and he didn't forget and he's done the right thing by all of his trumas and maisers and everything. Whatever's for him to consume, he's done so under the correct conditions. And it's all good. And then, Pasuk Tesvav states, Hashkifa, Mim'on Kajicha, Min Hashemayim, look down from your holy abode, from heaven, uvareches am chesham, bless the Jewish people. Ves hadama shenasat alano, the land you've given us, kashenish batala v'seinu, eretz zavas halav udevash. That's the final pasuk of this declaration. It's a call for blessing. Now, how is it the conclusion of the declaration? What are you doing? Are you declaring or are you requesting? That's what you're saying when you did the mitzvahs. You've done the mitzvahs. And the final pasuk is, bring down blessing upon us. What's that got to do with what you just said? Well, clearly it's connected, because what you're saying is, I've done the right thing by me, by the people that I'm meant to be taken care of, so you do the right thing by the people that you're meant to be taken care of. And that's how Rashi explains it, which is an amazing thing. It's a kind of like a Jewish chutzpah, in a sense. We've done our part, so now you do your part. Rashi says, Asinu mashe gazarta aleinu. We've done what you decreed for us, what you decreed that we should do. So now, aseata mashalecha la'asos. To begin to to request that Hashem fulfill his part. That's a big chiddush. And moreover, it's not normal, as if to say, it's not the standard way that we normally relate to mitzvahs, when you think about it. As much as we're always, shall we say, hopeful that good things will happen, we know that mitzvahs will bring blessings, but isn't it true that a person is meant to fulfill mitzvahs because Hashem told them to fulfill the mitzvahs, without necessarily having thoughts of reward, and certainly without following up with a request for reward, which is basically seemingly what we've just did. So how does this work? So Meshech Chochma says that the answer to this issue here is to appreciate that these mitzvahs partake of a very unique category. The Gemara says in Maseches Tanis and Daf Tes, generally speaking, you shouldn't test Hashem. As the Pasuk says, Lo sinasu, Hashem lekechem. Don't test Hashem. And what does it mean to test Hashem? I'm going to do this mitzvah and see if Hashem does something good in return. That's not a good way to do things. But amazingly, the Gemara then says, but there is one exception. And the exception is Maaser. When it comes to the mitzvah of Maaser, it's apparently acceptable to test Hashem. You could do it. And where do we see this? It's actually mentioned explicitly in the Pasuk, in the Navi Malachi, Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yud, which is the Haftarah for Shabbos HaGadol. And by the way, one of the reasons why that section of Malachi is the Haftarah for Shabbos HaGadol is because it's always Erev Pesach. And that's when all Maestros need to be taken care of. This declaration takes place on Erev Pesach. But that's what the Pasuk says within that Haftarah, Havi was Kolam Maaser El Beis HaOtzar, it's final clearance. Bring it all to the granary, make sure it's all taken care of. That's the topical connection between that, aside from everything else. But it's a very linear mitzvah connection between that Haftarah and Erev Pesach. It's about Maaseros. So the Pasuk says, it's a well-known Pasuk, Havi was Kolam Maaser El Beis HaOtzar. Bring all the maaser to the granary, to the threshing floor, to the storehouse. Ubechanuni na bazos, Hashem says, and please, bechanuni, test me with this. See if I don't, im lo eftach lechem es arubas hashamayim, I'll open the windows of heaven, varikosi lechem bracha ad belidai, and bestow upon you blessing ad belidai until without end. So we see a most fascinating thing, and it's a straight translation of the Pasuk. With regards to Maaser, Bichanuni Nabazos. You're allowed to test Hashem. Is it encouraged? I don't know. It seems to be. He says, Bichanuni na. Hashem almost seems to be encouraging it. It's okay. Most interesting niche, shall we say, within mitzvahs. Generally, that's not the approach at all. But when it comes to Maaser, Vakasha, Bichanuni Nabazos. Says the Meshech Chochma, well, part of the Torah's license to test Hashem and to do a mitzvah in expectation of reward is that it's perfectly acceptable to request it. And therefore, because this declaration is all about Maaser, Vidui Maaseros, the various Maaseros, therefore it's part of that mitzvah is that it's appropriate to follow it up with a request for reward. Hashkifa mim'on kodshecha min hashamayim. So that's the comment of Meshech Chochma. One final comment, and this will come from the Tochacha. The Tochacha is very long. That perek is 69 psukim, very long. It's longer than the first one in Vechukosai. And there is a pasuk which stands out, really. It's in Perek Kafches, pasuk Mem Zayin. Very difficult to read the Tochacha. Calamity upon calamity, and it just seems to get worse and worse and worse. And then the Torah interrupts for a moment. In Perek Kavches, Pasuk Mem Zayin. The Pasuk states, Tachas Hashem avadatas Hashem Elokecha b'simcha u'betuv leivav meirov kol. Because you didn't serve Hashem in joy, with joy and with good heart, seemingly. Tachas means because, which means this pasuk is an explanation of all the calamities in the Tochacha. And as we can appreciate, many Mefarshim are very disturbed by this pasuk, because you really need to understand it. As important as we all understand, and the Rambam talks about it in the Nefachos Lulav, that joy within mitzvahs is an important part of the mitzvah. There's no question about it. It should be part of mitzvahs for all Jews. Yes. But mitzvahs with the absence of joy should lead to such calamity. It just seems to be a disproportionate response. A very, very harsh. It sounds like you're doing the mitzvahs, but it's not with joy. Are the consequences that catastrophic? Secondly, there is a notion that the two tochachos, again, the first in the end of Vayikra, and the second here in Devarim, parallel the two destructions of the first Beis HaMikdash and second Beis HaMikdash. Now, we happen to have information with regards to the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, and we know that it was destroyed over the sin of Sinas Chinam. Now, Sinas Chinam, baseless hatred, and not serving Hashem with joy are not the same. Which means that we already have information about what it was. How does that fit in with the pasuk, which gives us this entirely other issue of not serving Hashem with joy, which sounds like serving Hashem, but just not with joy. And the Shem Yishmuel has a wonderful comment here. Shem Yishmuel says, there are certain things that people do with joy. I mean, most people, if they're a normal person, there's certain parts of their life that they do with joy. Which parts? The parts that are important to them, whatever it may be. I mean, the thing that they really see as, this is my calling, this is my life, this is it. That's where they put their energy in, that's where they put their... And that's where you'll see that's where their geschmack is. That's where their joy is, that's where their heart is. Okay. The question, it's a major statement, and certainly food for thought. Not a simple matter. But the question of whether a person does mitzvahs with joy is really a question as to whether a person sees their mitzvahs in that way or not. In other words, mitzvahs are either something that a person does as alongside the thing which is really what they're all about, or mitzvahs are what they're all about. How can you tell? Well, how do they do their mitzvahs? Do they do them in a perhaps more mechanical way? Maybe looking for leniency, if not the easiest way to do the mitzvah, etc. and so forth. Lackluster. Because they save their luster for whatever else it is that they do. It's a statement about what mitzvahs mean. And what difference does it make? Because depending on where your priorities are, that will affect the way you look at other people. A person whose priorities are in the temporal realm, everyone else is a potential threat because the temporal realm has finite resources. But a person whose priorities are in the spiritual realm, all of a sudden you have a different perspective on temporal matters. And spiritually, it's infinite, there's enough for everyone. And temporal, it doesn't really matter that much if someone else takes something. It's a different relationship altogether. To begin to unravel the mystery, the black hole of Sinas Chinam, much of what it is one is instantly suspicious of someone else merely for existing, because their existence is potentially taking something from me. But that's only true in terms of the finite resources of matters of Olam Hazeh. And therefore, when the Gemara says that it was over Sinas Chinam, and the Pasuk says it's over not serving Hashem with joy, the two intersect. Because if a person serves Hashem with joy, that goes a long way towards ridding Sinas Chinam. Because if the person's primary calling is in the area of mitzvahs, other people are not a threat in the same way. And Sinas Chinam it dissolves much more rapidly. But if a person's joy is saved for temporal matters, if that's where your joy is, that's where your suspicion is, if a person may be able, maybe taking something from there. That is how he combines it. And the truth is, it brings to mind a fascinating explanation of Rav Kook Zatzal with regards to the mitzvah of Mayim Acharonim. Mayim Acharonim, without going into the different communities and customs of yes and no, but the Gemara talks about it, as certainly in pure terms, the Gemara discusses it. And the question is, What's it all about? What's the background to my makor? So what do we know? Well, they used to have a certain type of salt, because melach sodomis, which is very pungent, remains toxic, very corrosive, remains so until today. Somehow, or for some reason, they used to have it at the table. It had a very enhancing, it gave, I guess, a kick to whatever was on the table, but you don't want it on your hands by the time you're finished. In other words, table is one thing, but you don't want it on your hands because you put your hand to your eye, it can damage the eye. In words of the Gemara, in Maseches Chulin, Daf Kuf Vav, melach sodomis, mesame esaynai, can blind the eyes. I mean, that's a pure health concern. Okay. Nowadays, we don't have that salt. Okay. I mean, we do, but and people put it on their face, but it doesn't. It's not on the table with the eye thing. But there is another Gemara elsewhere in Maseches Brachos in Daf Nun Gimel, and the Gemara there comments on the pasuk v'hiskadishtem v'yisim kadoshim. Sanctify yourselves, should be sanctified, should be holy. And the Gemara says those two terms are the washing before and after the meal. V'hiskadishtem, elu mayim rishonim. V'yisim kadoshim, elu mayim acharonim. So that's very interesting. Because two such different perspectives on the same thing. On the one hand, the Gemara in Chulin says it's about damaging your eyes, it's about salt. And the other Gemara says it's about being holy. I mean, that's not the same thing. So I guess depending on which stage you join in the Daf Yomi cycle, I mean, your first encounter with my Macharonim will be very different. And along comes Rav Kook. And Rav Kook says that ultimately, the two are the same. They are two sides of the same coin. And the reason why is because the whole concept of having salt at the table. And what does it mean? Salt represents taste. It represents enjoyment, a bit of time. And even the very strict Torah diet, which is in Pirkei Avos, Kachidaka Shel Torah, Paspa Melach Tochel, even when you've got nothing, you still have a bit of salt. As bread and salt, Umayim B'Mesura Tishteh. Even the austere diet and regimen of Pirkei Avos didn't leave you without salt. Because everyone needs a bit of time in life. And it's okay. But sometimes it can take over. Sometimes, in addition to enjoying life, life becomes about enjoying life. That's a very dangerous time. Because once that becomes the goal, one's perspective on other people who may be perhaps detracting from that goal, I mean, they are literally threatening what my life is all about. And there's no room for them. And that's really what happened in Sodom. That's why Sodom became so corrupt and became so cruel and became so constitutionally cruel because they began with such abundance. It was so fertile there. They had everything they needed. Everything was wonderful. And it went from everything being wonderful to life being about everything being wonderful. And then they closed their doors. And there's no room for anyone else because they're taking what's ours. But this is what our existence is all about, enjoying what's ours. And there's no tzedakah, as the Navi says in Yechezkel, Yad Ani Ve'Evyon Lo'Echziku, there's no help, there's no one, there's no one else exists. Says Rav Kook, salt enhances life, but the salt of Sodom blinds the eyes. And what it means is enjoyment is very good, but if your relationship with enjoyment is the way Sodom related to enjoyment, you're blind. You cannot see anyone else. You cannot see their needs. You cannot see their situation. You cannot see their concerns. You can't see anything. You're blind to anybody else. That's the problem. Well, that's the problem. What's the solution? The solution, says Rav Kook, is the Azu Gemara. V'yisim kadoshim. Be holy. And what does it mean, be holy? I mean, obviously, it means many things, but what it means largely is develop a higher vision of life. Have a more transcendent vision of life. Life is about more than just enjoying the physical world. And respond to that. And aspire to that. And that's called netilas yadayim, right? You wash your hands, right? And you add that godly element even to physical things because that's really what it's about at the end of the day. And what do you do by doing that? By assuming a higher vision of life, you release your eyes because all of a sudden your resources, there's room for other people. It's not all about enjoying life. And if a person, someone else wants to enjoy, that's okay. Kol dich v'nyeseh v'yecha. And therefore, if the salt of Sodom and what it represents is the problem, then Kedusha is the antidote to that. With that, he harmonizes the two Gemaras. Certainly much to think about, a very wonderful interpretation of Rav Kook. We'll leave it over there for this evening.